Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Alex Simpson from the California Innocence Project on behalf of Petitioner Kimberly Long. There's three issues that I'd like to talk about today with the Court. First, with regards to the sufficiency of the evidence claim, first is that there, based on the facts that were presented to the jury and to the state court, that no rational trier of fact could have found Kimberly Long guilty beyond reasonable doubt. The second is that the state court's decision and rejection of the appeal was objectively unreasonable.
For that same reason?
That's correct, Your Honor. And the third issue, which I'd like to talk about, is whether 28 U.S.C. 2254 D2 may be used in sufficiency cases like this.
We've already held that it can't.
Right? Well, and I
disagree with that.
I think that this particular case presents very specific reasons why 2254 D2 should be used in insufficiency cases, but I certainly understand that this is my last argument, so that's not
the thrust of it for the end. But let me just zero in though on the first,
because yes.
This is the thing that gives me the most trouble with respect to your argument. Do you concede that we have to start our analysis from the premise that your client was dropped off at 120?
Our argument and our position is always, are you saying in terms of the legal posture?
We're given where we sit,
right?
The jury has obviously heard this evidence, albeit not live, from Mr. Dills. But he clearly says that it's 120, and if you read the evidence in the light most favorable to prosecution, as we're supposed to, Do you agree that we basically start our analysis from that point?
I think that Your Honor's question is a valuable one because of the issues with regards to the state's position of the prosecution's theory and discrepancies that the evidence in the record had presented before the state court and before the trial court.
So what's the answer to the question?
I think specifically the discrepancies that were established at trial indicate that one cannot rely upon Jeff Dills' sole testimony.
Isn't that the province of the jury? Granted, this is a circumstantial case, but as it comes to us, we have to accord deference to the state court, for one, and secondly, under the governing standard for sufficiency of the evidence, we have to examine all the evidence in the light most favorable to the jury's verdict of guilt. So in view of that, we had Dill's testimony that he dropped your client off between 120 and 130, and there was a neighbor who more or less corroborated that. So I guess you're waffling in answer to Judge Watford's question, but it seems to me that we have to take the evidence in favor of the verdict. And when you discuss the sufficiency or not of the evidence, it would be most helpful if you could also present it in that light and why, even in that light, in your view, it's not sufficient.
Well, I think there's two answers to the question. The first, with regards to 2254 D2, is that even if we're just looking as to whether or not the state court's determination was an unreasonable application of the law, there are guidelines that have been established that state that in making that determination, the failure of a state court to give appropriate weight to all of the evidence means that its conclusion is objectively unreasonable, or that even with a deference due by statute to the state court's determinations, the federal habeas court must look to the totality of the evidence in evaluating the state court's decision. So with regards to Jeff Dills' testimony, I understand that Jeff Dills' testimony was that he dropped off Kimberly Long at a time that's earlier than what all of the other witnesses and all of the other evidence show.
Except the neighbor.
Well, the neighbor was not consistent as to whether or not it was Jeff Dills that they heard in the parking lot, or excuse me, in the driveway, or whether or not it was actually the victim, Oswald Condi. There was the consistency of the neighbors were that every single neighbor, and there's six witnesses, Juanita and Alex Sandoval, Philip Verga, Linda Alexander, Rosa Whistler, and Brian Foster, are all consistent in the statements that they heard a motorcycle pull up at around 2 a.m., that a car alarm went off, that shortly thereafter Kimberly Long came out asking for assistance and screaming, and eventually 911 was called approximately 9 minutes later. So they're all consistent with each other. They're all consistent with Kimberly Long's statement that that's when she was dropped off. The only there's no reason for these witnesses other than having some sort of group hallucination to establish that this chain of events was what they remember from that evening. That's okay. The reason why.
Let me put it in these terms.
Certainly.
Because I think we have to assume that the jury heard all of the evidence you just ran through and concluded that she in fact got dropped off at 1:20. Because if she got dropped off at 2 a.m., the evidence indisputably established that, I would say there's no way a rational jury could have convicted her, right? But you do have this very specific testimony from at least one witness who puts the time much earlier. And so I'm just going to tell you, I'm starting from the premise that she got dropped off at 1:20. So help me work forward from there how a rational jury couldn't have said, geez, you know, her story is that she got, you know, she walked in and immediately saw him in the condition that he was. If they believe that, in fact, no, she really was dropped off 40, 50 minutes earlier, why wouldn't that allow a reasonable jury to say, you know, she probably did it?
I think the answer to that question is that, first of all, based on the court's review, the court does have the ability to review whether or not the state court determination was objectively unreasonable. So bundled into that determination and evaluation, I believe this court is able to assess whether or not the jury's determination, even though it was supported by one witness whose testimony was not subject to cross-examination, who did not have the ability to answer questions with regards to some of the other evidence that had later been established. For example, that the neighbors of Kimberly Long weren't actually interviewed by the time that Jeff Dills gave his preliminary hearing testimony, so they could not have cross-examined Jeff Dills on that particular aspect, whether or not he remembered particular facts correctly.
But there was certainly circumstantial evidence, including things that a jury could consider consciousness of guilt. There had been a physically violent quarrel between your client and the victim. There was certainly, I guess circumstantial is the best way to put it, because nobody saw what happened other than who did it and the person who died.
And I appreciate Your Honor's question. I think that it's absolutely the issue that's before this court is what to do in a circumstantial evidence case. The circumstantial evidence was of motive, not of opportunity. The circumstantial evidence was that she had a quarrel with the victim earlier. But in a circumstantial evidence case, in order to establish that the evidence was objectively reasonable in a sufficiency case, there has to be evidence that proves beyond reasonable doubt not only that the evidence is consistent only with guilt, but also inconsistent with every reasonable hypothesis of innocence. And I'm quoting from the Ninth Circuit case, and unfortunately I don't have the citation in front of me, but the evidence should point, in a circumstantial evidence case, the evidence should point so surely and unerringly to the guilt of the accused as to exclude every reasonable hypothesis but that of guilt. So when we're talking about circumstantial evidence and sufficiency, we have to look at whether or not there are reasonable inferences that establish a person's innocence.
And so she got, let me be blunt, she got dropped off at 1:20, right? And according to her version of events, he's already dead or just about to die at 1:20. And she waits 50 minutes to call 911?
I think that our position is that the prosecution's theory is simply unsupported by the evidence. You cannot draw that conclusion. But if you do draw the conclusion that...
Why? Well, there's a witness who says, I dropped her off at 1:20 or 1:30, whatever you want to say. And she says, I called 911 within a couple of minutes after discovering this incredibly gruesome scene.
Correct.
Right?
And yes.
I'm just saying that those two right there, they can't be squared. And so why wouldn't a jury be able to say, she was there for 40 minutes and didn't call 911 until 209.
I think the issue is not necessarily what the jury could or could not conclude. I think the issue before this court is, what can you review? And if the
we have to review the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict.
But I think that the only evidence that we've got on the light that's most favorable to the verdict is an individual who was not subject to cross-examination, who did not appear in the trial, who didn't have
He was not subject to cross-examination?
Correct.
Why is that?
Because he had died between the preliminary hearing
but
and the trial.
But he was subjected to cross-examination in his testimony when he did testify at the preliminary hearing. Is that correct?
The facts of the case are that at the preliminary hearing, the police hadn't conducted the entirety of the investigation. So, for example, one of the issues that they could not cross-examine Jeff Dills about were the other statements that the neighbors had made, because those interviews didn't take place until months later.
Right, but he was subject to cross-examination. Whether or not it was limited by the evidence that was in the record, notwithstanding, he was subject to cross-examination. Otherwise, his testimony would not have been admissible at all.
He certainly was subject to cross-examination for the incredibly limited purpose of whether or not this individual should be bound over for trial.
Incredibly limited. I mean, it's the defense at that point has the option to cross-examine the witness regarding anything. So it's often a matter of strategy whether or not the defense attorney elects not to engage in extensive cross-examination, but that has no bearing on whether or not the witness is available for cross-examination.
Well, I think all other things being equal, you're right, Judge Rawlinson. But the issue is, when you have not, if you are unable to cross-examine an individual because of trial strategy, that's one thing. If you're unable to cross-examine an individual because you don't have a sufficient amount of investigation that's been completed by the investigating agency, by the prosecutor, to determine whether or not there are other witnesses that were out there who did say that this other timeline was established.
Well, the prosecution isn't the only entity that's doing investigation. Defense attorney, the defense investigators are also doing investigation. So the onus is not only on the prosecution in terms of the evidence that's brought forward, right?
That's certainly correct, Your Honor. I guess what we're talking about here is, how far do we want to go with a legal fiction? If what we're talking about is that you have the ability to cross-examine an individual thoroughly during a preliminary hearing without the opportunity to have all of the evidence available to you, for example, the witnesses that said that there was a different timeline, then certainly we can say, and we can wash our hands of the situation, that Jeff Dills' testimony is reliable, it's credible.
Well, the jury heard it. That's where we are at this point. The jury heard his testimony and all of the other witnesses' testimony, and if there was some discrepancy, the jury had the ability to resolve who was more or less credible.
And I think the issue is, again, if you want to take that legal fiction far enough, we can say the evidence was presented to the jury, so therefore they could have relied upon it. I think that the issue
but
before
that,
this court,
that's not a fiction. It was presented to them, and whether it was, a little bit like saying, well, he just chose not to cross-examine for some strategic reason. There's still an opportunity. It's not a fiction. It isn't to your liking, but it's not a construct. There was cross-examination.
I think, Judge Graber, that the difference would be, in my mind, a choice to make it is to do a cross-examination with regards to evidence that's available to you, or not to do a cross-examination, is a profoundly different choice than choosing to do a cross-examination based on evidence that you don't have, choosing to do it.
But why didn't he have it if he could have talked to the neighbors. There's no indication here that there was a thwarted attempt to talk to the neighbors before the preliminary hearing either.
Well, And again, I think that the issue is, for the purposes of a preliminary hearing, that's a decision that the defense attorney may decide to make or not make based on other issues that have nothing to do with whether or not he wants to effectively cross-examine Jeff Dills. He may have other things that are going on, other avenues of investigation, and he decided not to go to those particular witnesses. What we've got in front of us here is a case where the only witness that establishes the timeline for the prosecution was not present to testify, was not subject to cross-examination about the witness's other statements. And based on this court's ability to review the totality of the evidence under 2254 D2, and this court's ability to review whether the failure of a state court to give appropriate weight to all of the evidence may mean that its conclusion is objectively unreasonable. That's the reason why this case can't stand.
Can I ask you just one quick question?
Yeah.
Why is the version of the testimony we have of Dills, why is it so much of it blacked out?
I'm not sure about that, Your Honor. If you'd like, I can.
I'll ask the government, but that seemed odd that we don't have the full testimony. But okay.
Thank you.
You may have a minute for rebuttal when the time comes, even though you've used your time.
Thank you.
So we'll hear next from the state.
May it please the court, Arlene Sabadal on behalf of respondent.
Do you know the answer to that by any chance?
Your Honor, I just put what was in the record I had, and that was the record that.
You don't even know what was said beneath the blackout?
No, Your Honor, because we just have the appellate record. We don't have.
And there's no explanation in the record as to why?
Not that I was able to see, Your Honor. Though
was
I do
the
believe.
Was the redacted version given to the jury in that form?
I believe it was given in that form. However,
there's no explanation as to why?
Not that I saw, Your Honor. I thought the exact same thing. There is another section in the CT that has the exact same one, so there's two versions, but I thought it was exactly the same. So I just put in the excerpts of record the exact same one. However, if you'd like us to do supplemental briefing on why that is, I'd be more than willing to.
I just would have liked to have seen what he actually said. That's all.
Your Honor, I don't know. I asked the same thing.
Do you concede that without Jeff Dills, I don't know what his first name is, but without Mr. Dills' testimony, that basically no rational jury could have convicted her? Do you concede that point?
His testimony is extremely important. However, there is testimony that corroborates his testimony, and that's the neighbor, Philip Verga, and his testimony was very detailed. He said, I woke up, my door was partly open.
He doesn't say, I saw Miss Long walk into her house at 1:20.
No, he did
right.
not. So he just corroborates Jeff Dills, and Jeff Dills is the main
without
evidence.
Without him, basically, I mean, the trial judge said, I wouldn't even have let this case go to the jury, and I tend to agree with that.
Yes, Your Honor. The trial judge did say that. The Court of Appeal said that Jeff Dills' testimony was extremely
pivotal. I can't think of another case where somebody could potentially spend the rest of their life in prison based on the testimony of somebody who never showed up at the court, and the jury just was given this transcript, a heavily redacted transcript at that, of his testimony. Does that impact, in your view, our review under AEDPA in some fashion?
Well, Your Honor, you have to take the evidence viewing light and most favorable to the prosecution. And in this case, with Jeff Dill's testimony and the corroboration of Philip Verga, who said he heard a motorcycle drive up at 1:20, and he also heard voices at about 12, and that corroborates also Jeff Dill's testimony that he, Ozzy, and Miss Long were at the driveway, and there was arguments, and Ozzy drove up and revved his motorcycle. And you could hear Miss Long, and Philip Verga was able to hear that. And he heard at 1:20 Jeff Dills, a motorcycle, presumably it was Jeff Dills, drive away. And then he also heard at 2:00 a car alarm, so that's also corroborated by other neighbors.
Did anyone else testify about hearing the car alarm at any point?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Did anyone else testify about hearing the car alarm at some
point? At 2:00, yes, several neighbors, I believe Juanita Sandoval, Alejandro Sandoval, perhaps? I'm not sure of the names, but several other neighbors all heard the car alarm go off around 2:00. And it was the appellant's expedition.
Did Mr. Dills ever say anything about the car alarm going off?
No, Your Honor. He would have been home at that time because he said he specifically was home
at 1:36. Well, maybe or maybe not. If he got the time wrong, he maybe not. Right?
Well, you know, when he testified, they specifically cross-examined him on how he knew specifically it was 1:20. And he said, I live very close by. It takes about 10 minutes to get home. I parked my motorcycle in my foyer. I got dressed. That took about 2 to 3 minutes. I set my alarm, and I looked at specifically at the clock, and it said 1:36. And so he was cross-examined on why he remembers it so well that it was 1:20.
How long after, I apologize for not knowing the exact date, but the date of his preliminary hearing testimony, how long after the events of this night was that? What was the gap in time?
I am not sure, Your Honor. I believe it was in 2005. I really don't know.
Weeks later? Months later?
Months, but I really don't know the dates, Your Honor.
Did he give a statement to the police right afterwards? You know?
Perhaps. I don't know, Your Honor. We don't get the police reports. We just get the appellate record.
Okay, but I thought maybe at some point during his testimony he was asked if he wanted to refresh his recollection. Or
I don't believe his
refreshed. You see what I'm getting at, though? I mean,
yes, Your Honor.
Presumably
there was a police report.
If it's 3 months later, the testimony of someone saying that I remember looking at my clock. I mean, I couldn't remember what my clock said when I went to bed probably two nights ago, let alone 3 months ago.
Well, Your Honor, we have to presume that the jury heard that.
But they never got to see him. I guess that's what's so bothersome about this case. You're conceding that without his testimony, the case can't even go to the jury. And most of the time, the reason judges in our position we have confidence in what the jury concluded because, hey, we weren't there. They got to see the witness, evaluate demeanor, hear the cross-examination, right? But none of that's present. That's why I asked you if you think that impacts at all our review under AEDPA, because I just can't remember a case like this one.
Well, it's not at all unusual for preliminary hearing testimony to be admitted at trial, is it?
No, Your Honor, because all we have to show is that it was that the witness was unavailable, and in this case, because he had died in a motorcycle accident, he was unavailable and he was subject to cross-examination, which he was here.
Because oftentimes witnesses disappear, they fail to appear, they change their mind and take the Fifth Amendment, so it's not that unusual for this to happen.
Yes, Your Honor.
Maybe you can just run through how exactly she got away with, or not got away, but how she could have possibly have done this. Even with, let's say she got dropped off at 120.
She got dropped off at 120. There was circumstantial evidence that she had motive and opportunity.
How did she physically do this without leaving any physical evidence connecting her to the crime?
She got there at 120. I think it's relevant that there was a dog, Odo, who never barked, and neighbors have testified that he barks a lot.
Help me with the physical evidence. I'm talking about the amount of blood that was sprayed all over this place, right? I don't know how she could not have gotten blood on her clothing. There's no how in the world did she wash all of that without using any of the sinks at the house, drive somewhere else and dispose of the murder weapon and her clothes and the like? Just, I mean, walk me through how she could have done
that. I think the fact that she didn't have anything on her is circumstantial evidence that she was guilty of this crime. The testimony was that there was blood everywhere, 360 degrees around. Yet she had nothing on her, and yet she testified that she went in there, tried to pick up Ozzy, touched him, ran frantically around the house, yet she has nothing on her. But there is evidence that the back door is open and that there is a running jacuzzi. And so she could have, a reasonable jury could have inferred that she cleaned herself off in the jacuzzi.
And left not a single drop of water around the jacuzzi, as I understand it, no trace of blood in the jacuzzi whatsoever?
There's no evidence to state whether there was water or not.
I'm sure, but the police investigators combed every inch of that property to see if they could come up with some blood, and they found nothing. Physically, how could she have accomplished
that? Well, Your Honor, this evidence was all presented to the jury, and they made the credibility determinations, and we must presume that they are correct. We can't second-guess them. So even if you or I disagree with it, it doesn't matter, because the standard is any rational jury and any fair-minded jurist and what they determined. And we are presumed that it's correct. And here they didn't even comb two blocks away. They only went to two or three houses down the street and behind her house. And there's testimony and evidence that there's a YMCA, a school, a shopping center that had plenty of garbage dumpsters that she could have dumped the...
So it was the prosecution's theory that if she came home at 1:20 and she had told... I mean, again, this depends on Dills, but she has said, I'm going to go kick his ass, that she could have killed him at 1:22 with a baseball bat, run out the back, threw everything away, came back, and called 911. I mean, I guess that's got to be the theory.
Yes, Your Honor.
And with 45 to 55 minutes, that would be sufficient to do that.
Yes, Your Honor, because she only had to go two blocks away in order to dump any of the items. And there's testimony.
Was there any physical evidence connecting any other person to the scene either?
No, Your Honor. And in fact, they.
So there's no alternative except for people who had a grudge who had alibis.
Yes, Your Honor. They did present alibi witnesses, third-party culpability witnesses. That was Joe Brogorski and Shina Lovejoy, and they both had alibis. And so they couldn't have done it. And there was evidence by John Condi, the brother of Ozzy, that there were golf clubs, that he played golf, that there was a golf club and three baseball bats by the front door when he visited about a month or two beforehand. And police did not find any golf clubs in the garage or by the front door, and one of the baseball bats was missing. And so a reasonable jury could infer that that was the murder weapon used to kill
Ozzy. By
somebody,
not necessarily by her. Let me ask you this. Was there any testimony from other witnesses about what she was wearing that night?
Only her own testimony, Your Honor.
Okay. There were no other defense witnesses who were with her that night?
No. That was
And did
that
the
presented.
Police did the police take her clothing that night?
I believe so, yes. I think it was a studded belt and jeans. They took her clothes, but there was nothing found on
What about the items she brought in after she got dropped off? The items she brought in from the house, I think it maybe was a helmet, some hats, her purse, and whatnot.
And they had no blood either, Your Honor.
Yeah, so your theory is that she was such, I mean, I think you have to attribute to her that she was basically a professional contract killer, that she thought, you know what, I'm going to leave these items outside, I'm going to bludgeon this guy with a bat, leave blood everywhere, and then I'm going to bring the items in. And I mean, I
don't think you have to show that she's a contract killer, but just that this scenario is reasonable, and it is. She had the time to do it. She had 49 minutes. She had the means. She had a car there. She had the opportunity to do it. And she kicked off her shoes when she first walked in, yet her shoes were facing out.
But
she says she couldn't
blood
find
on
her
the things she said on the floor, though.
Because maybe she had brought him in after.
But that's what I mean. If she got dropped off at 120, wouldn't she just leave her stuff there on the floor, see him there? She got mad at him for whatever reason, and there would be blood all over everything.
Not if she had left it outside and dropped it all off outside. I mean, she couldn't find her purse, her keys, her cell phone. Those were never found. Maybe they had blood on them, and those are the things she disposed of. And we know that she had those because she used them to hit Ozzy with them earlier, and Jeff Dills testified that they were in the bushes, yet police were never able to find them, and she said she couldn't find them either. So where were they? She probably dropped them off at the dumpster.
Or she walked in, and he was already about to die.
Then why didn't she call 911 for 50 minutes?
Yeah, I bet I don't know.
She did it.
I got to tell you, I have real doubts about whether she did it.
Well, Your Honor, whether you have doubts or not, the question is whether the jury could reasonably find that. And
whether the state court reasonably could hold that there was sufficient evidence.
Yes, Your Honor.
Even if we would come to a different conclusion, if we were the initial reviewing court, we have to find that they were objectively unreasonable in concluding that there was sufficient evidence.
Yes, that is the standard under ADEPA, Your Honor, and it was reaffirmed by the United States Supreme Court in Harrington versus Richter. And so that is the standard that we have. And, you know, the defendant constantly uses the wrong standard. The standard is whether the state court applied Jackson unreasonably, and here they did not. Because viewing the evidence in light most favorable to the prosecution, there was sufficient evidence to support Long's conviction for second-degree murder. She had motive. She had opportunity. There was plenty of evidence of consciousness of guilt. She lied on numerous occasions. And she had 49 minutes in order to do this, and a reasonable jury could infer that was reasonable. So unless this court has any other questions, I'd submit on the briefing.
You may do that. I think we've run out of questions.
And, thank you.
Counsel, you may have a minute for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors, and I won't take too much of your time. I just wanted to reiterate some of the issues that that are present in front of the this court, specifically with some of the questions that Judge Watford had. There was a dearth of evidence that showed that this individual committed the crime, and you have to consider the context of this case. Kimberly Long, and a number of witnesses testified to this, had been drinking since 10 a.m. that day. She had either had 17 shots or 20 shots of alcohol over the course of this period of time. So for her to come into the house, deliver 8 precise blows to the head of Oswald Condi, have the presence of mind to clean up completely without any drop of blood in any part of the house, leave her clothes either outside while this offense was being committed, or dispose of them by driving them away, even though there's no blood that's found in the car, it just makes no sense. With regards to the corroboration that Jeff Dills' testimony was incorrect, there were first responders who arrived at the scene who established that the victim was cold, that at the time that they found found Oswald Condi, rigor mortis had already set in, that the lividity had already begun, setting the time of death much earlier than even the 1:20 time.
Doesn't that count against? That seems like it cuts heavily against your client.
Jeff Dills has established, and other individuals have established, that Kimberly Long was not at the house at, say, for example, 11 o'clock. And if you're looking at rigidity and rigor mortis, lividity, that would be the time frame where an individual would expire to.
According to her version of events, he died about, 15 minutes before they got there? The EMT people?
There was a question as to whether or not in her mind that Oswald Condi had died shortly before EMT could respond.
That he was still breathing when she got there.
And I think contextually, the fact that this woman was, by any account, by any stretch of the imagination, very, very intoxicated, could cause her to draw an incorrect conclusion about whether or not the individual was alive or not.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of both of you. It's been very helpful. The case is submitted, and for this session, we will be adjourned.